This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Good evening. Tonight our guest is Dr. Catherine Lagun from the Sociology Department at Otago University. And the show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and myself, Shane Gallagher. Welcome. Now I'm going to start with my number of the week, which is 2. And that is the global warming will cut crop harvest by 2% each decade, according to a new study from the Commonwealth Science and Industrial Research Organization. The research by British, Australian and American scientists say that we should expect a decline in predicted crop yields that is larger than first thought and which would endanger food security across the entire planet. So in an analysis of more than 1,700 simulations they ran, they found that the situation will worsen in the second half of the century, with tropical areas worse hit than temperate zones. They also found that across all regions and all crops, including wheat, maize and rice, yields will drop by 2% each decade, based on about a 2 degree centigrade rise by 2050. However, for some crops, the situation is much worse, with wheat and maize in tropical areas experiencing a 40% decline if temperatures reach 5 degrees centigrade warmer than pre-industrial levels. So we have to keep in mind that with increased consumption and population growth, we will require a 14% increase in yields per decade in order to keep up with our current consumption of food, and we're actually looking at 2% decrease. So you can see that we're actually a bit of trouble. So that's my number of the week, a 2% drop in world crop harvest if we don't do anything about global warming. So Sam, what have you been thinking about this week?
I've been thinking about entrepreneurial hustle. I've just been to the launch of Audacious, the student business challenge. And you may remember from last year that we opened up the category of social good last year. And almost half of the 200 entries from students across the Polytech and university campuses were in the social good category. So it's a very much a latent demand, we think, for doing in that space. So it's people trying to do social good, but recognizing that you need to do that in some sort of business operation to make it work. So that's led me to reading a paper by John Colco this week about entrepreneurial hustle, the empowering role of teaching entrepreneurial hustle. And what they're particularly trying to do is to work on the challenge of people thinking that they can't do anything, thinking that they can't do anything to change the world. So while it's about the business experience, the bigger learning is about the idea that you can cause things to happen rather than just happen to you. And they identified that most students don't think of themselves as agents of change. So they set a very vague task for students to do. Students must earn $1,000 profit doing something legal. And they pretty much left it at that. And in fact, some of the feedback that they describe is the students saying, we would have rather liked this to have been more defined. And they say, no, that's the point. It is about setting your constraints and working out what you can and can't do. And it's actually in a course for computing students, but a course which is a particularly interesting one, which I'm going to read more about, a course for computing for development, which is quite a big movement, as you know, in computing. And so what they're looking at is how to get people from the sort of transactional model of computing as a pure engineering science or only supporting business to how do you support things in the real world. So how do you get things, how do you get people to wicked problems, ill-defined, unstructured messes, and they say in order to do all that sort of stuff, the first thing you need to do is know that you can do it. So understand that they're capable of making a positive impact. So it's nice to see that this kind of thinking about how do you get people to actually do things is taking hold.
That's fantastic. And we'll just have a quick word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
And our guest tonight is Dr. Catherine Le Guin from the Sociology Department at Otago University. And she teaches environmental sociology, where her main focus is on the relationship between the economy, social organisation and the environment, especially around how people manage the tensions between modern capitalist markets and the dynamic spontaneity of environmental life. So the kind of things she's looking at are how markets arrange to avoid to or benefit from biological animacy. We'll talk about what biological animacy is a little bit later, and how are biologies of things affected by economic practices. And we'll talk a little bit about what those interests are. And a really interesting thing that you did a dissertation on last May was in club apples in the American Midwest. And I'll ask you about that a little bit later. But first of all, Catherine, can you talk to us a little bit where you're from and how you wound up in Otago?
I'd be happy to. Thanks so much for having me. I'm just delighted to be here. So I'm from northern British Columbia. I was born into a mining town, well, a mining city called Fort St. John. And then I moved to Victoria at a young age, and I grew up there and did my undergraduate and my master's at UBC, where I did, I got a job working for a climate change research network. And part of that job got me really interested in the environment and thinking about the relationship between sort of economic structures and what people can and can't do with relation to environmental stresses. So then I started working for projects that were looking at community development on the coast of British Columbia. And then I went to, I did my PhD. I got into the University of Wisconsin at Madison and kind of switched my focus to agriculture and stumbled upon this sort of, this area of club apples. And I became very enchanted with it, and it kind of took me away.
And so how did you wind up in Otago? What was the story there?
I was finishing up my PhD, and I was working with a professor in my department called Michael Bell, and he knew somebody that was involved at the, or he knew Hugh Campbell, who runs the sociology department, and I had met Hugh Campbell, and I was really interested in CSAFE here, the Center for Sustainability, and so they started sort of, he was circulating a job, and I applied for it, and I got it, and I moved here.
Oh, brilliant. Excellent.
So what got you into, firstly, climate change? Is that something that you'd been aware of right through school, or was it a particular thing that got you in your undergrad program?
It was something that I had been interested in through school. I mean, I had been interested in global warming, and I had always been interested in sort of natural resources. And I think part of natural resources, especially fisheries. I've been really interested in fisheries work. And for fisheries, climate change just really came up as being such a sort of important influence on things like fish stocks. So then I became really sort of interested in this course, and part of the course is I met people that were engaged in this research, and then it got me the job. And then, you know, like once I got a job, I was just completely enthralled.
So let's go back to the club apples, because I'm really fascinated with these club apples. So can you describe what club apples are? And
I tried looking for apples this afternoon. It's difficult to get past the Macintosh computer apples to get to.
Tell me about it. You know, everybody thinks that I study computers. Everyone thinks I study apple computers, and it takes them a while to figure out that it's actually the fruit. But So club apples are, they're a thing that sort of has emerged in the Midwest, at least when I was there, and seemed to be sort of a phenomenon that was like distinct to that region at the beginning, and now is no longer distinct at all to that region. But so they're apple varieties that have, that they're patented, and, purchased by cooperatives. So in order to grow the apple variety, you have to become a member of the cooperative. And so my dissertation was looking at the emergence of these clubs, and I was really interested in sort of the economic and environmental world that these clubs were responding to. Like, what was the thing that these clubs would address that would make better? So I went out and I did research with I interviewed 43 people in the Midwest apple industry and sort of talked to them about the apple industry in general and why these clubs would be emerging.
So what were the drivers? Was it economic or environmental or both?
It was both. So I think that... So for the apple industry, so here's an example. A lot of the times when I ask these growers why the club apples would be something that they would be interested in participating in, they said that they would relate to the story of the Red Delicious apple. So the Red Delicious apple is an apple that it emerged in Iowa. It was originally called the Hawkeye. It was actually originally only 20% red. And then it was purchased by a nursery, and then it became popular, and it became, like, really popular, and everybody sort of loved this apple, and it was called the Delicious, and it got planted, but every once in a while, sort of a branch of the apple tree will mutate, and it'll produce apples that are slightly redder than the original apple. And this became kind of like a selling point. It's something that people like. People like redder apples. So they would take that mutated branch and grafted onto trees, and that mutation would become patented. And basically, this would go through so many cycles that at the end of it, you have the Red Delicious, which is like a fully red apple. It's got really thick skin. It was kind of overplanted, and the price of the apple just plummeted. And so you had these sort of vast acres of apple trees that the price that you would get for them had dipped below the cost of producing them. And so they just kind of... It became kind of a real crisis for the apple industry. And so the growers would narrate this system where they just sort of felt like an apple variety would get popular, there would be this incentive to be replanting these redder strains of the variety while the price would eventually drop because people had just been sort of producing them. So it was like a treadmill that they just sort of were thrown onto, and there was very little ability to sort of negotiate with retailers or anything about how to do things differently. So the club apple model seemed to be really beneficial for them because part of being part of the cooperative is like you have more negotiating power with retailers, but you could also have it in the license that you wouldn't, for these sort of red strains, that you wouldn't... they would be owned by the cooperative, so there'd be less incentive to just be sort of constantly cycling through these redder and redder versions of the variety. So it's sort of a way to get off of that treadmill.
And did it work?
I think it kind of has worked. I mean, so far, the people that I had been talking to had really sort of only started... They were only starting to produce the apples that were part of these clubs. But it seemed to be something that people felt was, like, really promising. And, and I think that there is a sense that it is working to some extent.
So what they're doing is they're trying to control the supply of particular apple brands into the market.
Yeah.
So that you avoid the collapse in price. And so is this a way also of combating the power of the purchasers of the big supermarkets, big retailers, to give them some clout? Is that also part of what they're up to? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they... So, like, in the U.S., you have so many producers, and you have packing houses, but really it's sort of producers negotiating with a very limited number of retailers. And the prices that get set for apples, growers have barely any control at all over them. So once you have sort of this cooperative where they can collectively market the apples, you do get to sort of have a conversation with retailers about the price, which I think is a huge advantage for them.
And do you think it's going to lead to better outcomes? It sounds like it's going to lead to better economic outcomes, but what about environmental and social?
I mean, I definitely think it will lead to better social outcomes because it really does sort of like facilitate this collaborative relationship between growers and sort of less of the real sort of competitive buying up your neighbor's farm kind of attitudes. And there seem to be a lot of collaboration between the growers in these clubs, but also like the grower community in general. And I think environmentally, certainly in the sense that, you know, whenever you're replanting trees with new trees, you know, like whatever will sort of slow down that process, I think is a good thing. And also in terms of, I think it's a lot of the growers that I talk to, they're not huge farms. They're mid-sized growers. They're mid-sized growers looking for some ability to sort of negotiate in the market. And in the sense that I think that mid-sized farms are really beneficial for keeping like value on the farm and for being able to be really progressive in terms of your approach to farming and your approach to growing apples. Yeah, I think that there are some environmental benefits as well.
What does a mid-sized farm in America look like?
Well, I mean, a lot of the growers that I talk to, I mean, the biggest people I talk to were probably coming up on maybe 500 acres, but most of the people I was talking to were like between 100 and 200 acres, which is actually not a huge farm. And, you know, they're competing with Washington, where you have farms that are, you know, 3,000 acres and much bigger. So,
and would they just be, so that'd be all planted at an orchard, and would they just be planting one variety of, all apples, or different kinds of fruit, or?
A lot of them are doing different kinds of fruit, but they would often also be doing different kinds of apples. So they would have like some apples that would be club apples, and often they'd be sort of participating in multiple different clubs at the same time. And then they would also have some of the sort of like more commodity apple versions, like the Golden Delicious or the Gala apples. So they'd be kind of doing a little bit of everything.
Last year, three years ago, in the last election cycle, we ran a series of election specials. We had all of the candidates that were anything to do with Dunedin come in, including Shane. We had to work at arm's length with Shane during that series. And one of the most interesting questions that we asked was when we got them to describe how they saw the relationship between environment and the economy. Mm-hmm. And some people said things like it's two sides of the same coin, and interestingly, a person from the right side of politics said they've got the two things that got nothing to do with each other. How would you describe that relationship?
Well, I think that my sort of approach to the relationship is that when we're engaging in sort of environmental activities, we are also engaging in economic activities. So I think that it's not so much that there are different sides to the same coin or antagonistic necessarily, but that when people engage in sort of practices, they're kind of orienting to both and perhaps producing them both at the same time. So I guess in terms of like the environment and markets, I think that there are certain sort of ways of there are certain ways that we've constructed our vision of the market, which does somewhat make it seem like the environment is different or is outside of that. But I don't think that that's an inherent property of economies in the environment, if that makes any sense.
So you're saying that the environment's not necessarily separate from the market? It just happens to be.
Well, let's see. No, I'm saying that I think that they're not actually separate at all. But in terms of the way that they are sort of articulated, or in terms of the way that we enact like policies, that they're separated in sort of our institutional practices. But if we were talking about like our everyday lives, I think our everyday lives are very much about both all at once and all at the same time.
But we're not stupid. Why have we let that happen?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's... I think there's something useful sometimes about analytically separating them. But I mean, in terms of, like, developing a sense of the market, I do think that as part of just the development of certain, like, disciplines, you know, the economy and economics. There was a time when, like, we had a vision of economics as being sort of like home economics, and it was something that was very practical and something that we envisioned as being about, like, the use of resources and very much embedded in time and place. And then at a certain point, that sort of changed, and it was almost like home economics became the sort of less scientific version of economics. And as a science, we became very interested in sort of like predictive models and something in a very much more sort of abstract way. And I think once you sort of take it in and abstract it out, it's very useful, but we have to sort of remember that that's a tool in which we use to see the world as opposed to an actual account of reality.
Because it was, I mean, the economy, you know, this idea of having an economy as if it's some sort of entity, mm-hmm. that only kind of came about really as an idea in the 1930s with the Great Depression, and people were kind of desperately trying to figure out what is this, what's going wrong. So the idea of the economy obviously came about, and, you know, and it's only the first time we start talking about it as a separate entity. And so is there... And that was at that point of economic crisis. But what is, you know, is thinking about these things separately and to allow us to analyze it also allow it, you know, make us think that these things are actually separate? Do you think that's where it's come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is a way in which we think about the economy as being very distinct from the environment. And I mean, I think this really comes out in the way that we think about the environment as perhaps being sort of where, like, it's, you know, the wilderness we retreat to, or it's some sort of like moral space that we go to, as opposed to like the economy, which is the sort of very utilitarian, very distinct sort of sphere. But I think that those things are produced.
So we talked about economy and environment. So what is environmental sociology? Can you maybe give us a quick definition of what that actually is?
That's a hard one.
Well, start with sociology.
Sociology.
So environmental sociology is really interested in sort of, the relationships between society and the environment. But really looking at sort of, there's a lot of different ways that people go about environmental sociology, but thinking about sort of how the structure of society influences how people feel about the environment. There's a lot of identity politics that go on in sort of framing environmental issues or thinking about the environment. There's a lot of issues around social class and access to the environment and visions of the environment and access to natural resources. So there's a lot of different points at which sociologists can become interested in the environment.
Can I just take a step back, just before I forget to ask this? I know it's economics rather than sociology, but what's your take on growth?
Growth? Oh.
We're asking very simple questions here, you know, nothing complicated.
Nothing too tough. growth. So I'm not 100% how I feel about growth or what I think about growth. I mean, I think that there's a way in which growth becomes a way that we talk about, like, the accumulation in general. And because history continues on, there are ways in which things happen cumulatively. In a sense, that is kind of a form of growth. But in terms of thinking about like needing to produce economic growth into the future forever, I think probably not a great way to organize our lives or our economy.
It's pretty fundamental to what we hear from most economists, not all of them. Some of them say pure version of economics doesn't include growth. So it's not embedded in what it takes to be a sociologist or anything like that.
No, I don't think so. I mean, as a sociologist, you're really interested in questions of distribution more than growth and where where growth is happening. I'm not sort of committed to the idea of growth. And I think, you know, there's going to be growth and there's going to also be contraction, and maybe that's okay. And there's lots of different forms of growth too. Like I'm sort of interested in this idea of like zero growth economies, whether those are possible or whether there's types of growth that are not sort of resource based, whether we can have growth that's really sort of like knowledge based or so much as like a revising current systems. That's can be a form of growth as well. And so there are lots of types of growth that are good, and I don't have sort of a blanket feeling about growth overall, but I am sort of tend to be more interested in questions of distribution.
I went and looked up the website of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's sociology department.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful looking place.
Yes.
Interestingly, in I think the first paragraph, they say that teaching, research, and public service are seen as part of the same thing. Indeed, we draw no boundaries between our research, teaching, and service missions.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests a science or an art, whichever way you describe it, a discipline, that is intricately connected to doing stuff.
Yeah.
Is that rubbed off on you?
I think so. I mean, I've definitely tried to. and it is a philosophy that's actually pretty vibrant, at least in my experience being a graduate student there. It's very alive and well. And just in the sense that, you know, like Wisconsin is such an interesting place and it's such an interesting state because it's so polarized. And Madison is sort of like this hotbed of progressive ideas and real sort of social experimentation. So I think that there is sort of this spirit of doing things and sort of trying them out, but also being very politically engaged. And I was there when there was, we had a governor there was a lot of controversy around some of the policies that he was putting forward, and a graduate student, we were very much politically engaged with what he was doing.
You don't have to check your coat in at the door and be objective when you're being a sociologist?
No, I think you do have to be. I mean, I didn't bring my politics into the classroom in the sense that I didn't tell people what my political position was or what their political position should be. And I think that, in general, that's a good approach to take when you're teaching. But I did give them the evidence that I learned as a sociologist, which is around things like, the questions about inequality and questions about access to resources and things like, labor practices and labor policies and how these affect the well-being of a community and the well-being of a state. And so, of course, I'm not, we don't preach, but we do sort of provide the evidence that we've had that perhaps has shaped our political visions.
Do you think that perhaps the fact that academia is being careful not to politicize those sorts of things, which are patently obvious, I would have thought, from a evidence point of view, that rather than academia being trying to be objective, maybe it's politics needs to back off. You know, what is politics' role in climate change, for example, heavily politicized in the States in particular?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we need to stick to our guns and say, actually, no, it's okay for us to be talking about these things. It's not a political issue.
But I mean, I guess it is sort of a political issue, though, right? I mean, and I don't think that you need to sort of abandon the scientific evidence to say that it's a political issue, just in the sense that, I mean, obviously there are people that are very upset about the idea of climate change, and it's a sort of political question of, like, why are they upset about it? Like what are the places that people are coming from that's informing how they're sort of processing this information about climate change, which seems to be quite clear and quite, you know, well-supported. So I think that it's almost like an anxiety about recognizing the political political sort of like underpinnings of these things that, in a sense, makes it harder to talk about it in some ways.
Because, I mean, this isn't a political issue. Climate change isn't a political issue in outside the Anglo-Saxon world, really. Mm-hmm. In the Anglo-Saxon political world, it is very much a political issue. But, you know, if you go to continental Europe, you go to Japan, you go to other countries, climate change, you know, you deal with it. And the way you deal with it is might be different depending on your political aspirations, but it's a scientific fact. This is undisputed. So have you had any insight as to why it became politicized? I know there's a political aspect to it. I mean, how do we deal with it? But why did it become so? Why is it, your political identity and your position on climate change become tangled up?
Right. Well, I think that part of the reason is, like Ulrich Beck and Anthony Giddens have talked a little bit about this, is that you have a lot of information being produced by sort of like experts and in these kind of like closed social environments, and then some of that information sort of comes out from this expertise, and perhaps people feel a little bit they don't actually have a good grasp of how that information is produced, and so in a sense, it's a little bit disempowering, in a sense, to get this information that tells you that what you're doing is wrong, or what you're doing is, producing climate change. I think that there is sort of a sense of disempowerment there that people feel very resistant towards. And people don't want to change their practices in their everyday lives.
What did your apple orchardists think about climate change?
They were actually, they talked about climate change as being something significant that they would have to consider in the future, and when they were, they talked about it as something that was, like, very real and that they were experiencing and very important for their lives. They were, like, pretty on the climate change, they were on that bandwagon. Yeah.
I'm just guessing, but I'm guessing that they voted Republican.
Well, I mean, I don't know. There was actually, the apple growers that I talked to were very sort of politically mixed. And there were, I mean, I didn't ask them who they voted for. But I was at this conference, and it was an apple growers conference. And this, a man came up, and he was a representative of this apple organization. And he had been sort of lobbying, I think. And he actually gave a talk where he talked about switching from Republican to Democrat and why he did that. And a lot of it was actually around labor issues because people were so sort of anxious about having the real tension around undocumented labor. And I think apple growers really started to advocate for having those undocumented workers documented and giving them some sort of safer and better working conditions in terms of their legal status. And so so they actually switched parties, it seems like, based on that. Oh. I mean, they were actually pretty progressive, I have to say. I was a little surprised.
You teach a course called Special Topic in Sociology, Soci 409, Environmental Sociology. I'm reading the blurb for it here. You talk about debates around material versus constructivist views of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
So the materialist versus constructivist view of nature. So, I mean, it's actually not quite as divided as it seems like. But there was this sort of big debate started kind of like in the 70s and 80s around how we as sociologists should think about the environment. And there's the idea that the environment is just something that's real, like environmental problems have sort of real, tangible, experiential influences on us, and we should deal with them sort of at face value. And then there's this other sort of camp that's really interested in the symbolic meanings that people attribute to in things in the environment, and really interested in sort of like the social construction or the sort of political construction of environmental idea, environmental things, environmental problems. And so there's these two sort of competing visions, and the constructivists are really sort of, they're interested in how the things that you see in the environment are kind of, they're based on your ideology, your sort of political background, or your socioeconomic status, and your sort of cultural tools that are around you. And that you can't really see an environment that is void of these things. So you're always sort of positioned in your view of the environment. And so it was kind of a debate. And now generally people say there's like a middle ground. They're critical realists or engaged in some sort of ways to marry these both together.
If you had to label, I'm coming back to the apple orchards, if you had to label those apple orchards, would you describe them as human environments? Are they a factory that doesn't happen to have a roof on it? Or are they some kind of modified nature?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, is a factory not kind of a modified nature?
It's a false dichotomy, I know, but how did the farmers perceive it? Were they fighting against nature? Were they working with nature?
I mean, I think that there's definitely a shift in the farmers that I talk to, that they're very interested in working with nature. A lot of farmers were adopting this this pest management strategy called integrated pest management. I understand that a lot of people do it here too, but it's basically instead of sort of blanket spraying your orchard, you count the number of pests that you see, and you very selectively spray depending on sort of your counts and what seems to be too much. And you're very much interested in sort of like attracting the bugs that manage the other bugs and sort of keeping everything in balance. And they're very much like involved with this. But it's hard because there's a lot of sort of policies out there that make it a little bit difficult to not treat your farm like a factory, like in terms of like food safety regulations. And like this one farmer said that he's supposed to keep track of all the deer that come into his orchard, and he's supposed to like make sure that deer do not come into his orchard. But, you know, how do you do that? And so he kind of built a fence around his orchard, and he's not supposed to allow dogs to come into his orchard, and he has a dog, and he had this cat that used to ride on his tractor with him, and he's not allowed to bring his cat into the orchard anymore. And it's kind of like these sort of ways to regulate the orchard sometimes do seem to be encouraging it to be more and more factory-like.
And is this what you mean by the politics of food or food politics? Is this part of what that is?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that in terms of, like, so we have these sort of food safety regulations, which are really sort of enabling very stretched out commodity chains. And it's just the form of sort of industrialized agriculture where we have these policies or these ways that we think about it being a drive towards efficiency or a drive towards just economies of scale. And that we think about it as not being a political issue, but when in fact we're building all of these institutions that enable that to happen or enable that to seem sort of normative or enable it to sort of seem natural. But it's political. And so I think that that's sort of what I think about when I think about the political economy of food or political food.
I'm still on the apple growers. Are they facing constraints? Is something scarce? something's scarce?
Yeah, I mean, it really varies a lot in terms of, you know, when I did my interviews, they had had a really tough year because of the weather. The weather had just not cooperated with them. I think out in on the West Coast, certainly water is going to become an increasingly difficult problem. The biggest apple-producing region in the U.S. is eastern Washington, and that is not a very wet region. It is a very dry region. It's essentially a desert. So, I mean, water, I think, is certainly going to become an increasing problem.
Is that there seen as a thing that can be fixed with money, like it is here, increasingly?
Oh, that's a good question. I didn't really ask a lot of people about water politics and what was going to happen with it. I talked to growers in the Midwest, and they were just kind of, they didn't think that it was going to be resolved. They thought there was just going to be, it was going to get harder and harder to have water, and maybe that was just, the apple industry was just going to have to deal with it.
I mean, what happens when, you know, domestic users of water and commercial users of water, like farmers, come into conflict over water supplies? Like, I mean, you can imagine in California now, they're facing this massive drought. And so you have people in Southern California wanting the water, people in Northern California saying, farmers saying, no, we need this water to grow the food because we grow most of the food for the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a tension there. Is that starting to... Are you starting to see that all across the country, or is that something that's, you know, these tensions over resources suddenly starting to kick in?
I think that it is kind of contested, but it's also something that doesn't necessarily enter the public sphere very often. So it's something that probably, I'm sure, you know, happens. People making somebody is making decisions about who gets the water, but I'm not sure that it's something that people necessarily talk about a lot or have a lot of conversation about. But I think in general, I mean, that's a tough question. Like, do you produce food, or do you just import food? Yeah. Food security.
In our case, we've got a very strong tension between the economics of the growing dairy industry and the water quality in the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if it's just about whether or not we can swim in the rivers, that's, you know, we could build a swimming pool beside the rivers. It's not just about swimming in the rivers. It's about what that indicates. Is this something that you see more generally, those tensions increasing?
Between the economy and
Between the economy and the environment and interest. I mean, it's depending on how you draw the model. It's interesting that the social side of it is connected to both of those. We need a healthy economy in order to run our schools or whatever. But we also like the idea that we can go swimming in the weekend.
Yeah.
And connected to that, of course, is it's not just the fact that we're swimming in the weekend. We also do have some sort of inherent value in the in the environment. It doesn't tend to get recognized, and I want to come back to that in a minute. But is that tension generally increasing when you go to people talking about environmental sociology around the world? Or have we just got ourselves into some hyper dairy is good, go down that and...
Yeah, I mean, I think that the tension is increasing. I think that it's something that people are ever more conscious of. It's definitely also a tension that really overlaps with things like social inequality and who is benefiting from the extraction of resources or producing waste or polluting, and who is kind of suffering the ills of that. And those are often, you know, not the same groups of people. And that's when it becomes like an issue of like sort of one group kind of fighting against the other. And I think that there are ways in which a lot of those environmental problems are becoming so much more visible. And, you know, now with environmental risks becoming so important in the way that we live our everyday lives, that those become so much more to the forefront.
Because when we talk about some people benefiting from this extraction and some people suffering from it, it makes the ideas of us being able to reduce all that to a triple bottom line. You know, we're not going to get to the point where we can have a number that says, even if it's three numbers, because each of those numbers have got an enormous complexity hidden in them.
Yeah.
So are we kidding ourselves that it's at all possible to have a triple bottom line?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that I think that there's a lot of issues around social inequality and sort of participation in decision making. And I mean, I don't think that we'll ever be able to come up with a number where we'll say, you know, like this is it, and we're all fine with this. I think that it has to be something that is an ongoing conversation and that people can sort of participate in and resolve environmental problems as they arise. But
on the other hand, the economic drivers were able to say, the economy is growing at 2.4, or this is going to have this particular impact on growth. That's a much easier story to tell than the complexities of biodiversity or social inequalities. We're on a hiding to nothing when we're fighting against these nice solid numbers.
It's true. It's tough. I don't know what the answer to that is. But I think just because we like numbers better, or we like the sort of number coming out of this sort of like this particular economic evaluation, doesn't mean that it's the one that we should be following or it's the one that we should adopt. I mean, if things are more complicated, they're more complicated. And just sort of, you know, choosing something.
So what do we have to do to communicate those more complex stories?
I really believe in sort of the power of conversation. The power of dialogue, the power of like political engagement as well. I don't know what political engagement is like in New Zealand. Certainly it's sort of declining in a lot of parts of the world. I think enabling sort of more democratic processes is an important piece of that puzzle, just so that people sort of feel like they have a stake and a voice in what can happen.
Now, you wanted to plug a free university.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Starting soon that you're involved with.
Right, so I'm involved with Dunedin Free University. We're a group of people. Some of us are academics, and we are involved in... we've been working on this idea of a free university, and our first event is next Wednesday. It starts at 6 p.m. At the South Dunedin Community Center. And we will be talking about why Dunedin needs a free university, and sort of related to these conversations about democratic participation and having conversations. So it's 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the South Dunedin Community Center at 261 King Edward Street. We also have a website at dunedinfreeuniversity.wordpress.com.
I'll put those links up on our site.
Great. Thanks.
I've got some questions. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I don't know. I guess yes and no. I consider myself to be very actively engaged with political issues, and I feel very sort of passionately about the environment and society and social inequality and access to resources. I'm not as much of an activist as I'd like to be, but I do sort of try to weave it into my everyday life as much as possible.
What challenges have you got over the next couple of years?
like in Challenges over the next couple of years. Well,
what's the big problems facing environmental sociology? What's the thing that's going to keep you up at night and excited to be getting up in the morning and writing things and talking to people?
Just the same as always. I mean, I'm just really, I guess I want to see what happens with these club apples, and I'm really interested in sort of the shape that agriculture takes in the future. For me, is really interesting. And can we possibly organize a new sort of agricultural system that is less contingent on these like large sort of commodity exchanges and commodity marketplaces? And you know, not that that is the worst thing, or not that I think that that's a sort of inherently terrible process, but there's got to be something else. There's got to be something else that we can do and that we can develop, because
people seem to want that too. The farmers market has grown up around the world all of a sudden.
Yeah.
I mean, some places it never went away, of course. In the UK in particular, they've always had markets.
Yeah. I mean, farmers markets are great. There's lots of different ways that I find that. So I study these club apples, but really there's lots of ways that people are kind of like emerging or developing some sort of way to sort of slow down or keep food more contained, whether it's through sort of like keeping local food, or keeping food that is bounded somehow by territory or by tradition. And I think that those are really exciting things and things to look forward to and to see what happens and whether they'll have like a big influence on agriculture overall.
Is there a cultural aspect to food? I mean, you know, how we relate to food? Why is it so precious for us? What's there?
Oh, because food is the best. I mean, we have a lot of cultural practices around food and food consumption. I mean, it's also just really important. Access to food and having food security is such a vital part of having well-being in your life, and I think that there is a lot of cultural practices around food and ways in which consuming food makes us feel at home, or makes us feel nostalgic, or makes us feel content, or makes us feel secure.
I mean, it's one of those fundamental human things, isn't it? Sharing food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, breaking bread with someone is, you know, it's one of those fun, you know, something that's been with, I suppose, the basis of our society, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're hunters and farmers, we share the food.
Yeah.
You know, the social group. Isn't food kind of the thing that kind of binds us in some really fundamental ways? And
absolutely. I mean, I think food is sort of like a very essential resource that we all share together, and it kind of comes to symbolize community and comes to symbolize well-being and health.
But that's beyond nutrition.
Yeah.
Because we know it's an essential resource for nutritional reasons, because we wouldn't be here otherwise. But you're saying there's something more than that?
Absolutely. I mean, being able to share food or having access to food has a lot to do with how we feel about our own sort of security and our own place in the world. And I don't think it's just about getting nutritional content or nutritional content. It's much more about social security as well.
Do you have any advice for our listeners? Is there anything that you'd like to see them do, take note of something, do something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I definitely think just being thoughtful about food and participating in alternative food markets, talking to your food suppliers, talking to your farmers, I think these are all good things, having conversations with people about food.
All right, so we're going to leave it there. You're listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio on 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 20th of March, 2014. Our guest tonight was Dr. Catherine Le Guin. And the host was Professor Samuel Mann and myself, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe in iTunes or on oir.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.